Hello and welcome to another episode of Investigating the Post Office Scandal. It's Monday the 1st of May and I'm sorry to say that Rebecca Thompson is currently indisposed, but we do hope to have her back on the podcast very soon. However, I have some company on this occasion. I'm delighted to say that I'm joined by Helen Lacey, who is both a director of Bath Publishing, which published the Great Post Office Scandal book, and a trustee of the Horizon Scandal Fund, who attended the compensation hearing on Thursday the 27th of April. Which is what we're all here to talk about. Professor Richard Moorhead, who is the project lead of a new study into the Post Office Scandal, which is a joint venture between the University of Exeter, where he is a Professor of Legal Ethics, and the University College London. And I'm also delighted to say that I finally got him on air to talk to me. It's Robert Nicholson, my producer at the Great Post Office Trial and a senior editor at Whistledown Productions, an award-winning producer to boot. So thank you all very much for joining me on a bank holiday. I'm very grateful to you for giving up your afternoon to do this. We all have taken quite considerable interest in the Post Office scandal in varying ways over the past few years. And I just wondered if, Richard, first of all, I could get you to try and crystallise what the importance of Thursday's hearing, the compensation hearing at the Post Office Horizon IT inquiry, was, and how we sort of got to this point.
So it's basically Sir Win Williams keeping his foot on the gas in terms of the compensation schemes, I'd say, trying to make sure that their various strands of those schemes are being dealt with appropriately and appropriately quickly, as insofar as they're within his terms of reference. So there have been various issues about certain people not getting interim payments, particularly public interest claimants. There have been issues about tax, issues about insolvency claims in particular, and general issues about the shape and nature and fairness of those schemes. He's due to look at them, of course, in phase five, which I think is towards the beginning of the summer proper. He's due to look at the substance then, but in the meantime, he's trying, I think, to ensure that the compensation schemes are dealt with appropriately, quickly and fairly.
I don't know how much of a inquiry watcher you are, but this seems a sort of very strange situation we're in that there is an inquiry going on into what happened in the Horizon scandal.
Yeah.
And this is almost a parallel inquiry running outside of the core phases.
Yeah.
To address something which is of paramount importance to the victims of this scandal. And from what I have seen so far, it doesn't appear to be going very well. It's a unique scandal, but this seems like a unique set of circumstances that has got to where we are in this inquiry. Is it unusual from your perspective?
I don't know. I think I don't know enough about other sort of, if there are similar cases, other cases, to be able to compare. It certainly is. I think the idea that there are two issues running in parallel is a good description. If I remember rightly, I think it was probably Alan Bates's efforts early on that kind of got it taken up. I think Sir Win recognised the strength of feeling in the sub-postmaster community, if I can call it that, and that he actually needed to do something to ensure that that issue didn't derail the main body of the inquiry. And I also think he probably felt, I mean, it's difficult to know for certain, it's quite hard to read in some ways, he probably felt that things were not going well and that he needed to do something to try to get things back on track. If that answers your question.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, Helen, you attended, Richard, I think you went there along as well.
I did.
Last week. Helen, you went along. Why did you go along and what were your takeaways from the whole day?
Well, I really wanted to go there primarily to support the sub-postmasters. I mean, they've been through hell and they're still going through hell. And I'm talking with my Horizon Scandal Fund charity hat on at the moment. I think there's with still major concerns that the money isn't getting to those people that have been affected. And as Nick, you will know, the charity is supporting people who are in danger of being evicted because the money's not getting through. And, you know, I just wanted to go along and see for myself, you know, and hear from the sub-postmasters how they feel about all this. And when I asked them what they were expecting to get from the hearing, most people just shrugged, oh, well, it'll be what it will be. And they kind of, not given up exactly, but they're just thinking, well, I'm just here and what will be, and I can't really do anything about it apart from being there and, you know, telling their stories again.
So describe the atmosphere in the room then, because I think right at the beginning of the day, Sir Wyn Williams said he wasn't used to having this many people attending. And I think that the turnout gives you a sense of the strength of feeling that the sub-postmasters have about this specific issue of compensation. What was it like to be in the room, and what kind of conversations did you have offline?
It was quite tense, actually. I think, you know, there were an awful lot of people. I don't know whether they know what they were expecting to come out of the hearing, but they knew it was quite an important hearing. And again, talking about the money, and a couple of people said to me as well, look at the number of lawyers that are there, which of course they would be. You know, we all understand that due process and everything like that. But one person actually said to me, look at all those people, look at all the lawyers, look at all the people that are being paid to do this. And, you know, they're all being paid, which of course they should be. But she said, how much money is being spent on this? On all them, you know, they're not getting their money, which seems to me, you know, really, really unfair. You know, they're having to battle all the time to get any kind of interim payments or you know, any kind of hardship payments. And yet, you know, there's all those hundreds of people involved in the inquiry and money's just not getting through. So it was quite tense. And then we'll probably come to it later on. But at the end, after Ed Henry's submissions, I think, you know, it really all came out. But I think you'll talk about that later, maybe, Nick.
Yeah, let's bring in Robert here. Robert, you're based in foreign climes, which precluded you from attending Thursday's hearing. But you've covered it, I'm sure, pretty extensively through looking at the transcripts and the YouTube recording of it. What factual points were raised during the hearing that you think we should be addressing in this podcast?
Yeah, well, there's a number. I mean, because obviously both the post office and government lawyers covered quite a lot of ground, as did then the various solicitors representing the sub-postmasters afterwards. I think the thing, and this gets to the parallel processes point that you made, Nick, the major tension here is about the completeness of the settlements versus the speed of the process. Everyone wants the settlements to be done as fast as possible. That's in everyone's interest, including the post office and the government, and they're constantly saying, let's try and get this done quickly. But at the same, and Sir Wyn has kind of launched this process so that the process of finding out everything in the inquiry doesn't delay those payments getting through. But at the same time, the tension is that if you give out the money before you know all the facts, before the inquiry has uncovered everything, are you going to be giving people as generous a settlement as they deserve? And are you, you know, potentially rushing things? And that was the kind of big tension that hung over the whole day's proceedings. And in particular, the major new suggestion that Sir Wyn has to consider from Howe & Co, that was then later backed by Ed Henry as well, of much more rapid interim payments to come next, to tide postmasters over to the end of the inquiry so that they can get money now, but they can also hold out for full settlements based on the full facts that the inquiry reveals.
I think there were two other big ideas that were floated, as well as that one that you rightfully point out about bringing forward some interim payments or making some more interim payments. The idea that came from the inquiry's own counsel, Jason Beer, that So Wyn should issue an interim report, which he's previously said to date that he's not minded to do. And this other idea, which I think both Howe & Co and Ed Henry KC were gunning for, which is an independent legal figure, ideally a retired judge, taking or making decisions which took the process out of the hands of the government, and particularly the post office, when it comes to resolving issues and speeding up the process. Richard, I don't know whether you're able to talk about this given your position as a member of the advisory board on these compensation schemes, but that particular point about getting in an independent authority, a final arbiter whose decisions will be binding to the various compensation schemes, is that something that you've discussed amongst the panel that you work with, or on what, if you're able to talk about it, what did you make of it as an idea?
I think I have to sort of be a bit cautious about this kind of issue, Nick, simply because anything that comes before the advisory board, I need to be able to talk to the advisory board sort of independently and as objectively as I can. And so I probably oughtn't to express a view on that here. I think the idea speaks to a general distrust of the parties involved, the post office particularly, if you like, being a pivotal, depending on your point of view, figure in the HSS scheme and the OHC scheme in particular, and that those schemes having an influence on the GLO scheme. So the HSS schemes had an influence on the design of the GLO scheme too. So I think people wanting to take it out of the hands of the post office, and perhaps also it may be a comment a bit on the sort of design of the scheme, which is sort of a bit, it's a sort of a litigation design is the way I would call it, which is
litigation.
It's an old phrase from my old days in the Civil Justice Council, but it's a sort of cases don't usually get resolved by litigation. They get resolved by negotiation in the shadow of litigation. And this feels a little bit like that, the sort of the way in which the post office and the parties try to thrash out a settlement. But it's very much at the minute, the last word it lies with the post office, unless the temperature, if you like, ascends even further. So I think it is sort of a comment on those two things is at least how I see it.
Helen referred to an incident which I think the tenor of Ed Henry Casey's submission was, as we've come to expect from him, very direct about the way that people have suffered. But the substance of it, where he started gunning for Herbert Smith Freehills, the law firm that's advising the post office. Again, I'm not too sure how much you're able to talk about that, but you have been very interested in Herbert Smith Freehills and their role in advising the post office pre this compensation phase and pre-inquiry. What did you make of his approach there to suggest that there was this fatal conflict of interest that Herbert Smith Freehills has, which dates all the way back to the recusal application in the middle of the Bates v Post Office litigation in 2019?
I mean, I think I can talk a bit about the conflict of interest issue, because it's something when I took up the advisory board role, one of the things I said is, look, I've been doing all this work on lawyers' ethics and I want to continue that. I'm not going to not carry on with that. And he does raise an important question, which is, what was Herbert Smith's role prior to the HSS scheme? And he suggested, as a result of Hodge, Jones and Allen's submissions, that they had advised on the recusal scheme. Kate Galifant's response, I thought, was counsel for the post office. Response was quite interesting. She started off by saying, well, actually, he's relying on this document, and this document doesn't say they've advised. It says they gave a presentation to the board, and she gave a date which seemed to me to be a few days after the recusal application before Mr. Justice Fraser. So she seemed to be saying, and she said, I think, in terms that they didn't advise on the recusal application. What she didn't say is what their role was and whether they had any role at all in the Bates litigation, other than this point about the board meeting they attended a few days after, if I've got the dates right, a few days after the recusal application.
And I think they did the mediation as well.
They did
the mediation that brought about the settlement.
Yeah. And then we sort of knew they were involved in the settlement. So I think there's the question about Herbert Smith's involvement in the settlement. There's the question about their involvement in the litigation more broadly. And there's the question about their involvement in the recusal. Now, she seems to be saying quite clearly they weren't involved in the recusal, advising on the recusal, but that's all we really know. And we can see they got involved quite quickly afterwards. Ed Henry's response to that was, something was essentially, I think, I forget the phrase he used, but they may not have advised on the recusal, but were they below the battlements, was his phrase.
Below the parapet.
I beg your pardon. All right. I don't know where I've got battlements from. So one of the things that I've always wondered about that, about Herbert Smith's involvement, is big corporates in litigation sometimes have a firm running the litigation and another firm sort of advising the board or something like that on strategy, sort of watching over what's going on. And I wonder if, and I don't know, but I wonder if Herbert Smith had that kind of role, whether that was the question Ed was asking at the end there. But it looked like where we ended up was the kind of conflict that Ed was suggesting in the hearing. It looked like Kate Galifant was saying, no, you're wrong about that. But she didn't, to my mind, say they weren't more involved than simply advising on the settlement, for instance. We don't know, another way of putting it, what their involvement was. And to my mind, Herbert Smith's role in the inquiry might be quite difficult if they are effectively part of the history. They're advising, representing, working with the post office on the inquiry, and yet they're part of the history and might have to give evidence. That would typically be a conflict of interest where the lawyer shouldn't act. So I think he's driving at that. I mean, he was also driving at it particularly in relation to the compensation point.
And did you understand that connection? I saw what he was driving at, the conflict of interest, but how it affects compensation was something that Sir Wynne Williams was quite keen to try and understand.
So what I think he's saying, well, I think there's two points. One is the general, it just doesn't feel isn't fair because they have an interest in trying to protect the post office's interest because they're partly involved in the history that led them to this point. Okay, there's that kind of point. The point he seemed to be emphasising more, so we help create this mess, we're going to try and minimise the mess for you, I suppose, would be the kind of argument, if that makes sense. The other thing that he seemed to be saying was that the whole history of this matter, from Bates through Hamilton through to the HSS, has been to re-victimise or aggravate or deepen or extend the problem for the sub-postmasters, and Herbert Smith are part of that story. That's the other way of seeing it. So they're kind of involved in making things worse. I think if you talk to sub postmasters, as I know, well, I can't speak for Robert, but I know Helen and you do, Nick, from time to time, probably quite a lot, I should say, they feel that the simple fact of their involvement in the settlement is enough to raise questions about why they're kind of so heavily involved in the compensation scheme.
Yeah, well, let's just play the moment where Ed Henry did suggest that perhaps Herbert Smith Freehills were below the parapet in some way, because it was quite extraordinary. I don't think I've heard it at the inquiry to date.
I can put it bluntly. Why does the post office not want to countenance abuse of process? Why will they not answer the questions put to them on the 8th of December? Because HSF wasn't a new broom. HSF was part of the problem. It was, as it were, an oily rag that tried to tarnish the reputation of the judge. Deeply implicated. That's the problem. Why don't they want to countenance abuse of process? Because they would have to disclose all of that. And that is, in our respectful submission, utterly unconscionable. And that is why, sir, with regret, we have to make the submission we do, so far as HSF's continued involvement in those compensation schemes.
Thank you very much, Mr. Henry.
Sure. Sir, I wonder if I may ask the indulgence to respond on one point of fact. I didn't want to do Mr. Henry the discourtesy of interrupting him mid-flow.
Mm-hmm.
It suggested that someone should have corrected or objected to UKGI submissions. We don't and didn't, for the simple reason that they are based on a contemporaneous document, which is Bayes 5071. I don't ask you, sir, to turn it up, but can I just make it clear that that document does not say that HSF was involved in the recusal application. The inference that Mr. Henry seeks to draw from it is completely different from what the document itself says. I wonder if I might simply give the factual timeline. The decision was taken to apply for recusal of Mr. Justice Fraser on the 20th of March 2019. On the 21st of March, the recusal application was issued. On the 3rd of April, it was heard before Mr. Justice Fraser. On the 8th of April, HSF made a presentation to the board as part of the proposed refreshing of the legal team referred to in the UKGI submission. The recusal application was heard and refused by Mr. Justice Fraser on the 9th of April. It was thereafter that HSF were instructed. So they were not the people who advised on making the application. It is a simple point of fact. No doubt you will look at all the relevant documents in Phase 5,
yeah.
But it is important simply to put that down as a marker at this point before you consider Mr. Henry's submissions.
I'm very grateful to Ms. Gallagher. I'm not sure if I need to withdraw it, though, because there
I'm not going to let this continue. The facts surrounding it will be investigated.
They will, yeah.
And so that's sufficient for these purposes.
Thank you, sir.
To what extent your recusal point is necessary for your more general point, I will ponder.
Could I just mention one thing, and I promise you, one sentence...
Really? One sentence?
One sentence. If they were not formally instructed, were they acting, as it were, below the parapet? Question mark. Below the parapet.
All right, that's enough now. That's enough. That's enough. There has to be some decorum in these proceedings. I like to be informal, but there comes a line and we're about to cross it and we're not going to cross it again. All right? Mr. Maloney, are you ready?
So, Helen, there, a big round of applause for Mr. Henry's suggestion, which I think was surprising to me watching it, because it clearly expressed the strength of feeling by the sub-postmasters present. What was it like to witness it yourself?
It was very odd, you know, because while Ed Henry was still going on, and as you know, he doesn't do one sentence, he goes on and on a bit, you know, which is fine. But I could feel the tension around me, and I knew, as soon as he finished, I knew that someone was going to start a round of applause, which I know also is not the done thing, an inquiry. You know, you should be sitting there listening.
Yes, and as we heard, the chair sat on it very quickly, didn't he?
I don't think Sir Wynne was terribly impressed, but then when Ms. Gallifant then replied, and then Ed Henry came back, we did another round of applause after Ed Henry's second comment, and then Sir Wynne said, we need to really put a lid on this. I can't remember his exact words, but he wasn't annoyed, but I just don't think he thought that was the way the inquiry should go, and he didn't want a spat between Ms. Gallifant and Ed Henry. He knew that meant that, you know, things were getting out of control. But I honestly, I could sense that. I knew that there was going to be a round of applause. I could sense it all around me. Richard, I don't know whether you felt the same, but it felt all very tense, and, you know, people were very pleased that Ed Henry said what he said, not just about HSF, but about the emotional side of all this and what they were going through. It was quite extraordinary, actually.
Yeah, he talks in quite emotionally resonant language, generally, when he makes his submissions. I mean, the three council for the sub postmasters are quite different in their approaches, and he's the one that speaks with the most kind of. Emotional resonance is the best phrase I can come up with, I think. And I think that leads to... And so he I think the sub-postmasters generally like hearing him, because he speaks in a way that they sort of recognise and feel and understand. This isn't a criticism, but he speaks like a jury advocate, like he's speaking to the jury.
There is an accusation that could be made that he's playing to the gallery.
That's the other way of putting it, I think. And that might be. So I thought Sir Wynne's reaction was a little bit more than not annoyed. I think he was actually a little bit annoyed. And that might have been with the kind of the lack of decorum, as I think he saw it. I think that was the phrase he used. Or it might have been that he felt that Ed Henry was playing to the gallery a little bit. I don't know, or that it was in danger of going out of control slightly. He certainly stopped and said, this will be investigated, I think was the phrase he used, or something like that, which is good to hear. But it was an interesting moment.
But you do need a powerful advocate for the victims making strong points, I think. Otherwise, it becomes too much like a business meeting where everything is tidied up between the lawyers and the compensation scheme is chugging along and rah, 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 we're getting there eventually.
I absolutely agree. I think it's really important that they feel like somebody is speaking in a language which registers with their feelings as well as the kind of intellectual, if you like, points that can be made, which might influence the way the inquiry eventually sees the facts. I think, you know, both those things are really important. And actually, I don't, for instance, I wouldn't have a problem with occasionally people applauding. I know it's very unusual, and I don't think probably Sir Wynne would worry about that. He might worry about if it went beyond that, and so feels like he has to, I can't speak for him, but that might be what was running through his mind. But I do think it is really important. It's part of the process by which they feel like they've been heard.
Robert, you've got a difficult job in that you have to take a helicopter view of what's happening, not just in this compensation hearing, but in the wider inquiry, and look at this from a general listener's perspective. The big theme that came out of Thursday for me was trust and the lack of it in the process. There appears to be still no trust that this compensation process is at all fair by anyone who's involved with it, whether or not they've had their settlements or not. When you look at how big a deal this is with your producer hat on, and you're thinking, okay, what themes can I draw from this? How important is this? How do I reflect this? What are you drawing from Thursday as a whole?
Yeah, I think it's one of the notable things from how the day progressed was that it was in these two halves. We had the government lawyer, then you had Miss Galifant for the post office, and then the afternoon, the various solicitors for the firms representing different chunks of the sub-postmaster cohort who were being represented. And if you just stayed until lunch and then left, you might have got the impression that, apart from a few little kind of technical things, everything was frightfully collegial and running pretty smoothly, and it was all a bit slower than everyone wanted it to be, but, you know, that's the nature of the beast and all this kind of stuff. And it was only when you came back after lunch that all the sub-postmaster's lawyers came in to say, you know, this isn't at all collegial, you're not listening to us at all, you're not engaging with us nearly enough, and you're not taking the concerns of our clients seriously. And the thing that came through really powerfully, consistently, actually, I would say, not just with Ed Henry but also Mr. Maloney and others, that there is absolutely no faith that the post office will do this on their own. The post office was at pains earlier on to, on several different ways, imply that the external pressure from the inquiry, from the communications of Paul Marshall regarding Nicola Arch's case and other things, you know, that these had no effect, that the post office was doing this as quickly as it possibly could, and it was always going to do this. And there was no, you know, there wasn't really any need for the inquiry to pressure them to do anything. And in the afternoon, the solicitors were all saying, you know, the only thing that is getting any movement on disclosure, on these various things that we say the post office is slowing down, is pressure from the inquiry. So it was very much this big shift in tone in terms of the way the post office and the government are currently characterising the compensation process and the way the sub-postmasters feel it's being done. The post office and the government are both saying this is a new phase. We've moved past the phase where we were fighting back against this and obstructing this. We understand how big this is. We just want everyone to get their money as quickly as possible. And the sub-postmaster in the afternoon is saying, you haven't changed a bit. You are still obstructing us. You are still slowing this down. And you are now holding this August the 2024 deadline over our head like a sword of Damocles to try and get sub-postmasters to accept settlements that they aren't going to be happy with in the end. And of course, what they would argue is that that will come back to bite the government in the end. Just as the GLO settlement, the post office successfully negotiated a lower figure than the sub-postmasters wanted at the time. But as a result, that they haven't really, in the long term, been able to treat that figure as full and final. They've had to revisit it and try and find ways to get more compensation to the sub-postmasters. And the fear for people who want to avoid this dragging out, and the thing Wynne Williams will have his eye on here, is that if smaller settlements are made quicker in an attempt to draw a line under the scandal in individual cases, actually the sub-postmasters are going to have to come back to the table again and say, look, I took 20 grand in April 2023 because I was nearly bankrupt. I was about to lose my home. The bailiffs were knocking at the door and I wasn't in a position to say no to the settlement. But actually, knowing everything that came out afterwards in the inquiry, I was entitled to far more. And if the post office and the government aren't careful, they will have a lot of these cases that they think they've settled now that are going to remain scandalously undercompensated in the years to come. Or at least that's the argument that the solicitors for the sub-postmasters are continuing to make.
Helen, I mean, I don't know about you, but when I hear the stories that, people have been through, and this has gone on for two decades in some cases, people who we've dealt with and in the charity and that I've reported on, I was always under the impression that the final compensation sums that they'd be getting would be seven, possibly eight figures, bearing in mind what happened to them, where they would have been had they not had to deal with the post office or the Horizon Scandal Fund. And yet we are now starting to hear about sort of final settlement figures that sort of basically scrape over 100 grand, even if they're not clawed back immediately by the tax man. I mean, what's your overall assessment, just as an individual who's been watching this now for a while, of the way that things are going and the way that this particularly knotty problem of compensation has been treated by the government and the post office?
I can't speak for all the sub-postmasters, of course, but I mean, you know, so many of them are saying that, you know, the money's not getting through. And even when it does get through, they're paying off their debts. You know, so they're still in debt, they're still paying creditors, they're still paying family members that have lent them money to get through this in the first place. And, you know, even though they might be getting £75,000 in an interim payment, that's going off to pay debts that maybe are 10 years old. And, you know, they're not getting enough to actually move on with their lives, you know, and also trying to provide evidence. And again, going back to Nicky Arch thing, they're having to provide evidence about, you know, their Horizon shortfalls and so on. And when Mr. Chapman from the Department for Business and Trade was talking about the Nicky Arch situation where she had to provide evidence, she said to me afterwards, she won't mind me saying, she said, well, why did I need to provide any evidence? I was found not guilty. Surely that says it all, doesn't it? Mm. You know, she was not guilty. So therefore, you know, why has it taken all this time for her to get her interim payment? You know.
What do you think needs to happen?
I think that suggestion about the interim payments, the second level of interim payments, I just don't understand why it's not happened before. And if you end up paying people too much, well, I think you just have to take that on the chin and think, well, some people have got away with more money than they probably should have done. But so what? Really? Does that matter?
I mean, Richard, to what extent does this show a structural problem with the way that we deal with all these issues, maybe not just postmaster compensation in this particular scandal? Because I haven't read all the written submissions that were made to Thursday's hearing, but I have read Paul Marshall's, the barrister who Robert just mentioned. He represents some of the same clients that Ed Henry KC represents. And he said, he said to the inquiry that you've got a problem whereby the post office and their lawyers essentially set up the initial compensation scheme. And they have a duty to their client. They have a duty to the post office. And the government, although it says it wants to be fair, and it's obviously doing great things by bringing you and Lord Arbuthnot on board and Kevin Jones as part of the advisory board, but it still has a duty to the taxpayer to give away as little as possible to the applicants. That has to be the way that it works, because or if I got that wrong, if I mischaracterized that,
I think that's Paul Marshall's argument. It would ordinarily, a commercial entity negotiating a settlement or paying compensation through a scheme, keeping the costs lower would be one of the things that would be quite strongly in their minds, and that might well be the case here. And have every reason as a sub postmaster for thinking that would be the case. Mm. It's a bit more complicated than that, and the post office should and would certainly say, I think, that they want to be awarding fair compensation. Whether that's what's really happening is obviously a big question. There's the issue of undersettlement, which I think.
Yeah. And this issue of abuse of process and the post office trying to claw back the ex gratia payment that some of the GLO claimants got as a result of the post office's initial settlement in Bates versus Post Office. These little hints that you're hearing that for all the fine words, actually, when it comes down to the nitty gritty, the dirty business of actually negotiating and maintaining your position, that the post office isn't necessarily playing fair. Or doing the best as it possibly can by the claimants rather than its own interests.
Yeah, I think putting the substance to one side, which I don't think I know enough about yet to comment on, even if I should comment on it. But if you look at it structurally, the basic problem is that let's imagine that these are judgment calls rather than clearly right or wrong answers. Just for the sake of the argument, there are judgment calls to be made about whether to pay X or Y, to pay this head or not that head, to pay X, to take into account ex gratia payments or not, whatever the issue is. The problem is that those decisions are being taken by the post office on the advice of HSS, perhaps with the government,
HSF,
the Treasury,
rather than HSS.
HSF, sorry, I beg your pardon. Thank you. With the government and the Treasury lurking in the background saying whether or not they can or can't fund it. So, you know, you've got those kinds of issues, and that just doesn't feel very independent. So it's not at all surprising, again, whether it's right or wrong, it's not at all surprising that some postmasters would say, this feels wrong, you know. Particularly that would be the normal situation, quite before you talk about, you understand the history of what they've been through with the involvement of the post office and the legal teams that have worked with them in the past. So it's structurally, it's very difficult to persuade. It's always going to be quite difficult to persuade the sub postmasters that they've been fairly treated in compensation. But if you've got a scheme administered by the post office, with the help of lawyers that were involved at some stage in whatever stage that was in the Bates settlement, or perhaps somewhat prior to that, then it's a very hard sell to say you've got an independent, well-run process because of the people involved.
Mm. I mean, it's really interesting that you talk about a judgment call and separating it from right or wrong, which has moral implications. Mm. Because I think all of us sitting here, and any right-minded person who's been watching what's happened over the last 20 years and maybe even picked it up on the basis of the Fraser judgments, is morally outraged by what happened, would want to see all of the people who have lost out in such an egregious way, not just restored to this phrase, restored to where they were before, or put back to where they should be. It's also with an apology, you know, with a sum of money that will never compensate them for what they've lost, but goes some way to giving them comfort. As an apology. I don't know whether that's called aggravated damages or whatever you call it. There doesn't even seem to be any sense of that. Now, I don't know whether that's not the way English law operates or UK law operates.
Yeah.
But there doesn't seem to be any sense that these people have suffered. They've lost years of their lives. They've spent a lot of it in misery. It's broken down family relationships. And what we're going to do is we're going to bung them some money, which we could, you know, the minimum we can get away with, and then hope they go away, rather than go, oh, look, we really messed up here. We need to actually be giving you something that compensates you for that damage done. And this maybe goes back to the post office's argument about abusive process, that they're not prepared to countenance that. What is the moral dimension that comes into this, and how can it be assessed within the context of this legal, what did you call it, litigation?
I think the process is dominated by the idea, the normal idea about damages in contract and tort disputes. So the normal cases where damages are paid, you know, when you have a bad car accident, or a business deal goes wrong and you sue and you get compensation. That's the idea of restoring people to the position they would have been, but for the harmful act, whatever the harmful act is here. And here there are probably a series of harmful acts for the particular sub-postmasters, certainly the ones with the harder cases. And that's why I think that idea is dominated the thinking. There is a bit of space, exemplary and aggravated damages, for thinking about how you go further than that. English law isn't like US law, where compensation payments can get much larger than we see here. But there is clearly, I think my reaction to the case is similar to yours, is just the horror at what these people went through, the way that they were treated, and that clearly does require proper compensation and working out what that is. I mean, it's a very difficult question, partly because you're trying to compensate for money with something that you can't compensate with money. What is a loss of a limb like? What is 20 years ruined worth? What is your children being spat at in the street worth? What is your son saying they don't want to bear your name worth? You know, how do you put a figure on those things? But there needs to be a really solid good faith effort to try to compensate these people properly for those things. I think everybody involved would say that's what they're trying to do, and whether you believe them or not is a very different question. But it is a hard thing to do, and I think having the central figure in this story, apart from the sub-postmaster, the post office in charge of that, is obviously deeply problematic from that point of view.
Robert, how do you approach this as a journalist? Because this is such an odd story in that everyone agrees that something really bad has happened, and you're kind of in the detail as to how to then try and make it good. And that moral element is not really, I suppose, for people like us to try and call, but we still have to bring it out because that's where the emotional connection with the story is, not just for the listeners, but for the victims themselves.
Yeah, it can be complex as journalists, and obviously we've worked through it in a period of time when it's evolved, right, in terms of how much of a consensus there was about how big the scandal was. You know, when we first started calling it the widest miscarriage of justice in UK legal history, that was something the Post Office disputed at the time. I think they probably wouldn't dispute that now after the quashing of the convictions and things like that. Obviously, sometimes when it's purely factual, you just stick to that and you don't let the warring sides kind of distort that at all. And in terms of the moral dimension and conveying the moral dimension, I've always been a believer in the fact that it's sort of egotistical for the journalist to appoint themselves as the arbiter of that. You know, in terms of someone to call out the Post Office and say that they've done something wrong, you know, am I the right person to say that that's happened, or is Alan Bates? It's Alan Bates. It's not for me to say either way. You know, other people have more authority to do that, and obviously more independence to do that without compromising the trust of their audience that they're going to deal with all parties that are being like looked at in a programme fairly. And so you sort of get two birds with one stone. It works all round. But I think that trying to kind of convey the trust they've lost. I did want to pick up on one thing you said earlier, Nick, about the 100 seeing compensation payments that barely scrape up 100 grand. My back of the envelope maths on the figures that the Post Office gave at the inquiry about the historical shortfall scheme suggested that the payments that have gone to the 1,600 or so sub-postmasters who they've settled with in that scheme, the total amount that they say they've paid out, which includes the payments to those sub-postmasters and also interim payments to some of the other 350 who they're still negotiating with, total about 60 million, which comes out at a maximum, even if we exclude pretend that those interim payments don't exist, of 40 grand each. And obviously we don't know what those cases look like. Many of those cases could be dragging the average down because they're genuinely cases that only involve much smaller amounts of money in the first place, both postmasters who were affected but not necessarily ruined, didn't necessarily lose their jobs, etc. But still, the figures we're often talking about here are substantially lower than
certain. Yeah, figures. And I think you're right, skewed by the fact that the Post Office with the HSS scheme went after the low-hanging fruit and the smaller sums, which they could just essentially disburse without too much investigation quite early on, and these might have been four-figure sums. And also that total sum included the amount that then gets immediately clawed back for tax as well, so we're not talking about the net amounts that the poor sub-postmasters are receiving, but we did see the more complex cases heading up towards six figures. And then we had that dreadful case that Tom Witherow in the Daily Mail did in his last big piece before he moved to the Times about the gentleman who had £300,000 given to him or certainly more than 200,000 and almost the same amount taken away from him, so that he only had £8,000 to actually as a net compensation sum, which I think perhaps shifted the dial in terms of the politicians and the public's understanding that there appears to be, certainly from what we've been hearing on Thursday, some fundamental flaws in the whole compensation process, to the extent that as someone who's sort of watched this for a while, I mean, you spoke about the weariness in the room, Helen, of the sub-postmasters, that ennui, that sense that, well, it's just another hearing. You know, we've gone past the stage of thinking that this is going to resolve anything spectacularly or anything big is going to happen. It's just another talking shop for a whole bunch of well-remunerated lawyers to get together and argue the toss over various sort of aspects to this thing without the fundamental problem being properly addressed. I don't know whether that's the right assessment.
I think you're right. They're tired. They just want an end to it. They're just fed up. I go back to the tax thing. I can't quite believe that they didn't foresee the tax issue before they even created these schemes. They must have known that there would have been some kind of tax issue, an inheritance tax, and of course the bankrupt. I can't understand how very well-paid lawyers that were developing these schemes didn't actually think that that might be an issue. How come it's all just suddenly come apart? And, you know, Dan Needle, you know, he's the one that's, you know, really pushed it out there and said, you know, look, something needs to be done. I just don't understand how they didn't know that that would be an issue.
And why it takes someone who's new to the story to come in and investigate it and make a noise about it. I'm not saying this in the post office's defence. I'm saying it as a way of almost compounding the stupidity. They underestimated the value of the claims that they would receive to the historical shortfall scheme by a factor of 9 when they set it up. So they weren't even thinking that they would be paying out, as I think Chapman said, or Galifant said, that they weren't thinking that they were going to be paying out that much money, and therefore didn't think that the sums that they'd be handing over would trigger this higher rate of tax. But as you say, that just illustrates how little they knew about how much damage they'd done, even in 2020, when you already had the Fraser judgments and the group litigation featuring more than 500 people. So there is no, as far as I can see, there is no excuse for it. Go on, Bob.
Well, I was just to say there was an interesting reading between the lines of what the post office and the government was saying about the tax issue in the hearing. There was sort of interesting, almost like a poison pill in it, where they would suggest that it wasn't that they didn't see it coming, and that the whole thing, I think they were implying it was a bit of a red herring, because they were saying that essentially they were always factoring it in, and so that the offers that they previously made, where they knew it would be taxed, they were offering compensation deals what we might describe as a gross figure, and that now when they were making new offers that were exempted from tax, that they would simply be offering less, that they would offer
that's my takeaway from that as well, which is was a change of position, isn't it?
Yeah, but it what it suggests is that they're saying that, you know, when they made these payments that had the tax included, they were more generous than the offers that they would have made if the tax was exempt.
Before we move on to other things, can I just get your summaries then of your experience of watching or participating in Thursday's hearing? Start with you, Helen. What do you think about where things need to go? And from the specific points that were raised, do you think we're going to be hearing going forward?
I think what they need to do straight away is to give a second interim payment and then work out all the numbers afterwards. That's what they did suggest on Thursday, is that give another interim payment, then spend however long it takes to actually work the exact figure out, and then pay them the balance. And as I said before, if the interim payment that they get is more than what the final balance is, I know it's taxpayers' money, I'm a taxpayer as well, I think you just have to take that on the chin and say, well, OK, they've got a bit more than they would have done.
And that was a specific suggestion for the new applicants to the GLO scheme, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Give them a lump of money because we're going to be, because people are desperate. Richard, your thoughts from Thursday.
So, I mean, if I was trying to summarise the kind of the state of play, I think the issues around tax and the issues around insolvency largely seem to have been dealt with. And it's worth remembering that's progress. The issue around the issue we haven't talked about a great deal is the issue of timetable. So Sir Wynne clearly very worried about the the guillotine on the GLO scheme, for
which
instance,
is August 2024.
That's exactly right. Thank you. The idea of the second interim payment and the question mark over how were Herbert Smith involved and to what extent in matters at prior to the settlement agreement. So those were the big issues, I think. Apart from, there's one other thing around convictions. So the post office said they were going to review the rump of the 700 Horizon convictions to see which of those appeals would be concedable, to paraphrase it. And that was a new thing.
Yes, that's a very good point. That's actually almost newsworthy in that it could see the post office sending a letter to people who have criminal convictions saying, if you appeal your conviction, we will not, we can tell you now that we will not try to oppose it.
Yes, if they're as clear as that. The language they used wasn't quite as good as that. But because partly to address this problem of people not wanting to come forward to appeal their convictions. So after 2 years or so since Hamilton, they've woken up to that idea, which is good. It's a positive thing that they are doing that work to review the... it still leaves open the question about whether the... enough of the Horizon convictions have been successfully appealed, which is a different question. And there's the public interest cases too. But it's a positive development.
Yeah, and there's also the Marshall point as to whether the Court of Appeal's definition of Horizon being essential to a prosecution and therefore a potential wrongful conviction is wide enough to catch all the wrongful prosecutions. But
that's what I meant.
Do you have any confidence that a retired judge will be appointed to be the final arbiter on some of the decisions that need to be made in any of the compensation schemes going forward? Do you think that could be what even Jason Beer, when he was pushing Sir Win Williams towards issuing an interim report, might end up as being one of the conclusions?
I've got absolutely no idea.
Go on then, Robert, you summarise and maybe take up that point if you want to.
Yeah, I think that it's this continued distrust is the thing that's going to keep bedeviling the compensation process. And I think in particular, this way in which the, at least as the solicitors characterise it, the post office, I think, continues to behave as though it deserves more trust than the sub-postmasters feel it's earned. That they are expecting people to come to it very much as though they're behaving in good faith. And the solicitors are consistently pointing out steps or places where they feel they should have been consulted and weren't, or they feel the consultation was insufficient, which if you were looking to build that trust, that's what they say would need to have happened, and the post office has not done it. That question of whether the post office is ever going to be able to draw a line under this, if the lines are drawn on their own terms, is the big question. And they're not comfortable letting other people draw it. So it's a thorny issue, and it's going to keep these compensation hearings running, and it's going to keep Sir Win involved in the issue of compensation when you suspect he'd rather not be.
I think that's a really important point. And I did get the impression that the fine words from the post office were belied by the concessions that they were prepared to make, i.e. dropping the word historical from the overturned historical conviction scheme, dropping the word historical from the historical shortfall scheme, offering to meet people to hear what they have to say. You can imagine the meeting go, well, that's not going to cost us anything, so let's do that. That's not going to cost us anything, let's do that. When it comes to giving money back to people who've suffered horribly, that's when they start getting a little bit more... brutal about it. Thank you very much. It was a big hearing and there was a lot to discuss, and I'm sure we haven't touched on everything that listeners to this podcast would necessarily want us to, but I think we've bitten a big chunk out of it. Let's tee up what's happening over the next 4 days, because this is something that has been in my diary for a very long time. Robert, just tee this up for us. We've got Anne Chambers giving evidence for 2 days, and we've got Gareth Jenkins giving evidence for 2 days. Just tell me how significant these people are to this story.
This is one of the ones I think we've all had circled in the timetable for a long time. There's various reasons for that. Obviously, Gareth Jenkins especially is one of the most recognisable names in the whole scandal. His evidence along with Anne Chambers. They both gave evidence for Fujitsu that Horizon was robust. The fact that that evidence was not reliable is a major part of why convictions got overturned and were able to be quashed. That they knew things that they should have said at those trials and they didn't. They've been under criminal investigation for perjury by the Metropolitan Police for years. What happens in these hearings will likely play a role in those investigations and the question of whether they ever face criminal charges, which obviously some of the sub-postmasters they testified against would be very interested in. But we'll also just learn potentially an awful lot about how it came to the point that this testimony was given, how these people came to give that evidence, and who above them knew what they should have known, how they found out what they should have known. The big restriction on their evidence is going to be stuff that could affect their criminal trial. Metropolitan Police applied to Sir Wynne to have some stuff kind of taken off the table, and he acceded to that. Whether or not that massively curtails what we'll learn, we will only find out. But these are two people who played a really, really significant role in this whole scandal. We've never heard from them, and they're clearly going to be quizzed in really, really intense detail. So we're going to learn an awful lot about how the prosecutions worked, about how Fujitsu played a role in those prosecutions. And those are two of the really big black boxes that even as journalists who've looked at this story for a long time, we've never been allowed to see inside to this point. So I think that's going to be...
That's a great summary, Robert. Thank you very much indeed. The two things that we know, which I could possibly add to that, is that there was some discussion in this phase two of the inquiry about Anne Chambers being involved in the civil litigation against Lee Castleton and not being very happy about it, and saying afterwards that there was a feeling within the department that it shouldn't be happening. And there's also the application that Gareth Jenkins made to the inquiry to see if he could have an Attorney General's letter of comfort, essentially suggesting that he wouldn't be prosecuted for any evidence that he gave in oral testimony, which the chair of the inquiry, Sir Wynne Williams, declined to even ask for. So it does tee it up. And we obviously have to be quite careful about what we can say and what we do say about this. But yes, journalistically, and I think just from a layperson's perspective, it is going to be, as you say, an opening up of the black box. I don't know whether you have any further observations on that, Richard, about what you would be looking to hear from or what you would be wanting to get answered over the course of the next 4 days.
Well, if Gareth Jenkins does give evidence, and I saw a rumour online that he might not be this week now. I know he was slated to, so I don't know if there's been a change or if that's just a rumour. But if he does, I want to hear about what he knew, why he didn't disclose the bugs in cases like Seema Misra's, what his role was in the Bates litigation, because he was clearly providing information to witnesses in Bates, which was then going into their witness statements.
That always struck me as odd, because I know we now know why he wasn't used as a witness, but presumably that's acceptable procedure, is it? Because no one raised that as problematic, they just highlighted it as something that was happening.
Well, so it depends, I think, on the precise circumstances, but it strikes me as odd. There may be hearsay problems. I would have thought they were well ventilated in Bates, so I can't really say much very sensible on that.
But I guess he's going to be asked about it.
Well, and what happened when Altman and Cartwright King started looking at cases? Who talked to him? What did they say? What did he say? Did anybody speak to him after he told Simon Clark that he'd not been entirely frank about bugs, if that is what he said to Simon Clark, you know? So there's a whole set of questions about Gareth Jenkins' involvement and role, and the way that he's his role continued up into certainly into the Bates litigation, which I think is really central to the story, certainly the legal story.
My concern about this is that obviously there are good reasons for the Director of Public Prosecutions asking the Metropolitan Police to investigate Anne Chambers and Gareth Jenkins' role, and obviously they have questions to answer in that regard. I would just hate for their investigation to be limited to Anne Chambers and Gareth Jenkins, given what seems to have happened elsewhere in the post office, not just Fujitsu, with regard to possible criminal activity. Helen, do you have anything to add on that issue?
Not really. They've got very different roles. I mean, what I've noticed over the last few months is that Gareth Jenkins' name has cropped up a lot. He's been in all the documentation. Anne Chambers less so, because she was only involved in Lee Castleton's case, I think. I think she was only used once as a witness, an expert witness. But Gareth Jenkins is all over the place. I don't know how they're going to get through it in 2 days.
Richard, I know we have to lose you very soon. Can you just quickly tell us about this new project that you've launched in collaboration with University College London and the job advert that you've put out? What are you hoping to achieve over the next 3 years, and what have you got the funding for?
So we're recruiting a postdoc researcher, so somebody to work with us for 3 years on the project. We're hoping that somebody with experience of professional ethics, legal process, criminal justice process, those kinds of areas. We are digging deeper into the scandal to understand the role of lawyers, in essence. That's phase one. And phases two and three, they're a bit more technical, and talking to sub-postmasters about their experiences of the justice system. So to try to understand a bit more of the miscarriages of justice side of things, in particular, so their experience of plea bargaining, for instance, to give you an example. So the same kinds of things we've been doing, but in more depth with more rigor. The phases two and three are designed to try to understand the ways of thinking lawyers have that lead us to these problems. Why is it that lawyers, if we look at the case, the number of points at which lawyers have touched the case and things have gone wrong or things have not gone in the right direction, why is that? And to try to understand that by talking more broadly to lawyers about their experiences of, if you like, analogous situations.
Okay, that's interesting.
To sort of tease out this. So when you do an independent investigation, why do you think it is that we ended up here in the post office, or, you know, what are the pressures on you when you've done, you know, that kind of thing. So we're trying to tease out, the end point is to try to find practical improvements to lawyers' ethical frameworks, their ways of thinking, the ways they're regulated, to improve practice, to try to make the kind of things we've seen here less likely to happen in the future, I suppose.
Yeah, sounds fascinating. And the job advert is for a postdoc?
Postdoc.
Researcher.
Yeah.
And it's a 3 year. Is it 3 year?
3 years.
Wow.
3 year position. Okay. I'll retweet the details soon and kind of like.
And I'll put the details in the show notes as well.
Thank you very much
indeed for coming on. Sorry to lose you, and thanks very much for your time.
Take care. Sorry to leave. Bye bye.
Cheers, Richard. Sorry, Bob, Robert, you wanted to pick up on a point I made just before we said goodbye to Richard.
We're just saying that the question of criminal liability and whether it flows upward into the higher hierarchy of the post office, which is one of the things that lots of sub-postmasters have often called for senior people at the post office to be investigated for whether or not they committed crimes, possibly just because of the symmetry. You know, obviously people were falsely accused of crimes, and there's a sense that maybe the people responsible should be going to jail instead. That's how the sub-postmasters will characterise it. The question of whether there is criminal liability and real plausible criminal cases higher up in the post office, that starts this week. It's probably very, very heavily dependent on whether the people, because these are the two people who we know are facing real questions of whether they committed criminal acts. And probably if there is criminal liability that flows upwards, it starts with people lower in the organisation who may have committed criminal acts, detailing ways in which they were instructed to or encouraged by senior people to do that. That's probably how criminal liability would work here, right? So that starts this week. We will learn a lot about whether or not there is a plausible case criminally here over the...
Yeah, I think we've spoken to someone off the record who says that the way that the inquiry appears to be structured is to get as much information from those who were there at the start and from those who were lower down the rungs before they start talking to the people higher up.
It reminds me of when, because I used to listen to loads of stuff about the Mueller investigation into Donald Trump and various other American criminal investigations, and the way they described the structure of investigations into organised crime, which inspired these. And I recently made a programme about FIFA corruption, and we did interviews with people who worked in American law enforcement for that. And the way they always describe it is you go in for junior people and then you roll them up. and you get the junior people to testify about the people in the rung above them, the people in that rung testify about the people above them, and so on and so forth, with the leverage of potential criminal conviction hanging over each rung on the ladder. And from our perspective, in terms of the people that we know are at least, you know, face these questions, no one's been convicted of anything, and that's important to note, but for the people who face these questions at the bottom rung, that is Anne Chambers and Gareth Jenkins. So that's why this week's testimony is really pivotal.
Can we talk a little bit about episode 12 of the Great Post Office Trial? Can we announce it?
Yeah, why not? We probably can't announce it with a TX
Transmission date, that is, for non.
So we can, but we can say it's happening. People. I'm sure we can
don't
say
yet
it's
have a transmission date, but we're both working on it, aren't we?
Yes, we don't. We don't yet know exactly when it will come out, because it's about updating people with what's going on in the inquiry and investigations that we're obviously going to be doing alongside that. But we are hoping to get another episode onto. Yeah.
What would you like to hear in the episode 12 of the Great Post Office Trial, Helen Lacey?
Well, I'd like to report on what's going to happen this week. But, you know, if Gareth Jenkins isn't going to give evidence, I'd be very surprised if he doesn't. And the reason why is because Sir Wynne said at the end of the inquiry on Thursday that, you know, when he was being asked if he was going to do some kind of report on it, he said, oh, we've got a big week next week with two very important witnesses, as people will know. So if since Thursday at, you know, 4 o'clock, they've decided that Gareth Jenkins is not going to give evidence, well, that will happen quite quickly. I don't know. Let's see what happens.
Bob, what's your hope for this episode in terms of... Because we've got to pick up on what happened in phase two, because there's a huge amount of information that came out there, and I think the stories about Tony Blair's involvement in the Horizon Project was new to a lot of us. And obviously just hearing about just how badly Horizon was put together before it was rolled out is, I think, worth repeating for a wider audience. I mean, I'm fully aware that a lot of people listening to this podcast will probably listen to the Great Post Office Trial episode 12 when it comes out. But also we've got to try and tell the story for people who may be coming to it for the first time or who've only got a very, very wide perspective on it.
Yeah, I think we've always obviously... Radio 4 has a very wide audience, and there's a lot of people who follow the case through that podcast, and it's I think important and a newsworthy story for us to stay on. I think what it will be is about updating people with what's coming out of the inquiry, adding detail, I think especially to the parts of the story that the audience of the original programme already know. Because the bar of how much context we have to give to clear is lower there. So the stuff that particularly speaks to the kind of core egregiousness of the scandal. And I think as well to these compensation issues. I think we obviously did the first interview with Paul Scully in episode 11 that involved us being able to put to him a lot of the concerns and questions that sub-postmasters had and that hadn't previously been able to be put to him by media. I think there are lots of people who have ongoing roles in the questions of whether the sub-postmasters are going to get what they see as adequate compensation, who questions about how the sub-postmasters feel they're being treated in this process should be put and hopefully will be put in the programme. So continuing to keep up on what are the most newsworthy issues as the story progresses. You know, it's told the story in order so far. We told the story of the miscarriages of justice. Now it's time to tell the story of the inquiry and what it hopes to achieve and what we're learning from it.
Can I make an admission to you, Bob?
But it's difficult to be more detailed.
Since we started this project together, my relationship with this story has changed to such a degree that I'm kind of reliant on you from that outside perspective now, because what we're doing the book with Helen and getting involved as a trustee of the charity, it's the sort of the journalistic instinct that informed this initial approach to this story has made it quite hard for me to try and retain that when there are so many other elements sort of pulling away at you with regard to what's going on at it. And it's I mean, we had Richard on earlier, who has written very forensic, searing at times blog posts, certainly for his profession, about where the failings have been in this scandal. And now he's sitting on an advisory board appointed by the government to neutrally assess a certain element of the compensation scheme with a reach that is growing all the time. And all these little conflicts that build up around this story as you get more absorbed into it make it sort of harder and harder sometimes to try and steer a path through it that can actually be of use to people in some way. I don't know whether you find that, Helen, when you were sort of, you published the book because you were interested in the story, and then you find yourself as a charity trustee hearing horrendous stories from people who are in desperate need and then having to make decisions about funding for them and the like.
Oh, it is very hard. It is really hard. Can I just add one thing about the Series 12?
Yeah.
Right, sure. This member of my family will remain nameless, but she has been, obviously she knows I've been involved in this story now for 2 years, but even she said to me the other day, she thought that all the convictions had automatically been quashed. And I'm sure she's not alone in thinking that. I bet there are members of the public out there that think that everyone's convictions have been quashed and they've all got their money. And nothing can be further from the truth. And I think it's important to emphasise that, you know, these people are still going through, you know, this whole sorry saga to try and, you know, clear their names.
And so many of them as well, because we hear the stories. And then on Thursday, there were, what, about 10 or 11 people's individual names mentioned, all talking about living from hand to mouth, not having the money to pay.
And two people that died as well, of course. So we had, I can't remember their names actually, Robert Boyle and Isabella Wall. You know, they died and they've not had any money. And what appears to me as well, when they say that at the inquiry, and I'm going to say this because I you know, I can, because I don't have any conflict of interest or anything like that, but I it's almost as if the post office are listening to this and the, you know, DBT are listening to this, and then they sort of move on. And then, as you say, it's all about counting the pennies. It's about working out how much money people are going to get and trying to get away with the least amount of money. And they sort of hear that these people have died and then think, oh, right, OK, that's really awful. And then they move on. But it's a really big thing. People are dying before they get any money, and their families.
And I don't want to necessarily denigrate lawyers as a profession, because I've got to know quite a few of them over the course of this story, and some have become friends and some I have enormous amount of respect for. And of course, everyone has to get paid for doing the work that they do. But it does come back to that thing. What is the only class of people that has done well out of this scandal from start to finish? You know, apart from Fujitsu, to be fair, who've actually built a massively powerful brand within the UK on the back of Horizon's success. But yeah, it's the lawyers, and it continues to be the lawyers. And really, until people do have that closure and that compensation that they deserve, rather than not just what they need or what the government is prepared to allow them to have, it's there is going to be that gnawing sense of injustice, certainly in the minds of the victims, probably until their dying day. Because even if they do get showered in money, which they're clearly not going to, they don't get the time back.
To pick up on your question about the kind of the way the journalism around it has changed, I think that the good thing from our perspective compared to when we did the first series, in 2020, you know, this was a story that had not received the kind of national media coverage that it deserved. That it received occasional coverage from Tom Withrow and the Daily Mail, received national coverage, but for a small specialist audience, from Computer Weekly and Private Eye. But it wasn't a household name as a scandal in a way that I think it now is. Not because of our series strictly, but it was a contributor to kind of a set of large media coverage that it started to get in 2020 and 2021. And I think that the problem we had then was this sense that people were coming to it very fresh, and that everything we omitted felt like, as inevitably you do, you make 10 parts, but about a massive story that goes way bigger and way deeper. Every guest you cut out, every theme you underplay, that feels like it's been omitted from the historical record of the whole story, or from the public record of the whole story. And I think the inquiry doing this big stone tablet of what happened, and the heterogeneity of the media coverage, so it being covered in different ways by lots of different papers, lots of different very capable journalists looking at it in different ways. Dan Needleman looking at it in his way, looking at it in his way, Tom Witherow doing their so from the Mail, now at the Times, to big audiences on front pages with proper coverage, sort of takes the pressure off a little bit. We can pick out things that we think other people have missed, and not be too worried about being comprehensive in the way that we used to be worried. So I think that's the biggest advantage that we probably have now relative to it. And then in terms of the balance on it, or the idea of having to retain a degree of independence, that is of course true. But it's also the case that, you know, it's never been necessary with this scandal to do any more than just tell people honestly and accurately what happened. That is the big difference. People know what happened, and that has created movement and progress and calls for policy and provided the impetus all on its own. You don't need to editorialise it. You don't need to characterise it. You don't need to be opinionated about it, really, as journalists. You can leave that to other people, in my view. All that has ever been necessary with this scandal is to uncover what you have done over 10 years of working on it. Now, far more than 10 years. 10 years when we started on it. Is uncover stuff that the post office would rather at the time have stayed very much hidden.
And there's plenty of it.
And that's it, really. That's that we're in. And the inquiry will keep doing that now, and we'll keep trying to do our jobs and bring more stuff out into the public eye. And then for other people to say, this is how much money should then be paid, this is how much, this is what policy should be changed, these are the heads that should roll. You know, I'm very relaxed about that not being my job. I don't mind that, because that's a very difficult job, and it's really important that there are other people, very serious people, who do that and who are activists on this. But the role of
I do take Helen's point as well, that the general perception amongst the public, which happened in two big hits in 2021, was that everyone who was wrongfully convicted has had their conviction overturned, and everyone's got compensation. You had the obviously the big day on April the 23rd, 2021, where the Court of Appeal overturned 39 convictions, but that hit the news, and the way that was absorbed by the public was, there has been a terrible wrong, it has now been righted. And then 2 months later, you had Paul Scully standing up and saying there will be a compensation scheme, from which the takeaway publicly was, everyone's been compensated too, story's over. And I think I honestly think it probably wasn't until Tom Witherow's piece on that poor gentleman whose name escapes me, who I mentioned earlier, who's 80 years old and had most of his compensation taken away from him, leaving him with £8,000 for what he'd suffered, that people and you know, policymakers as well as ordinary members of the public realised that there was something still afoot here. And so as journalists, I think we obviously have to stay as tightly on that as we possibly can, without being too niche about it, whilst also telling that wider story and the developments that are coming out of the inquiry.
I agree, because we want to give people insight into what happened in the origin and the really fascinating information that's coming out. And it'll be, hopefully we'll get an opportunity to do that, and we'll find some way to elegantly fit everything that really matters into the programme. But I do think that the focus in terms of the journalist's role as this scandal continues to unfold is keeping in people's minds that it's ongoing. You know, that is very newsworthy. And I think you're absolutely right, Helen, as well, to point to the fact that people maybe think that there's been a much harder line drawn under it than has. You know, the sub postmasters definitely don't feel that this is over, and the audience should be aware that
just a couple of lines that came from the inquiry, which I think I ought to put into this podcast as a kind of warning shot. The chair suggesting, I think, that phase five wouldn't start until the autumn, and also suggesting it would take months for him to write his report. So if we are now thinking there are 7 phases to the inquiry, I think that's right, and phase five won't start till the autumn, and it's going to take many months before he reports, we are probably not going to see a final report before the hard stop on the GLO scheme in August 2024. That was just my you know, I'm guessing, I'm absolutely guessing here, but maybe an informed guess that will be the case.
Yeah, the big challenge for them is trying to get it all, and this got referenced in the inquiry hearing on Thursday, is getting everything done before a general election. Because if there's a general election, purdah on civil servants means that a lot of stuff has to grind to a halt before, as soon as a general election is called. Which obviously they're probably not going to take the post office inquiry into account.
Oh no,
and call the general election.
And it could be May,
so it
next
could come
year.
At any minute.
They were talking about autumn next year. I mean, it's usually May. The latest it can be is December next year. Is that right? Because it was December 2019. So that is going to be a massive spanner in the works if and when it comes.
Yeah, I think Wynn will very much. It won't matter, I think, so much if Sir Wynne can already be in the shed at the back of the garden writing out the report. And that might work quite neatly. Obviously, you know, one of the most important bits of his report in that gets overlooked is policy recommendations and how the post office should be reformed and how it should be run, which was the original point. You know, before he was statutory, that was basically the whole premise of the inquiry, was we need advice on how to reform this whole machine. That will be, you know, potentially quite a useful government to be in the document to be in the in tray of an incoming government, whether it's the current party re-elected or a new party coming in. Either way, a new government with a mandate, with an ability, with a sort of momentum towards passing legislation, it will be quite good for Sir Wynne's report to sort of land at roughly the same kind of time that they come in. So the timing could work out very neatly, but it could also completely derail the conversation. It could derail disclosure. It could leave us in limbo much longer than we want to be, and then create a bizarre reset if we have a new post office minister, a new trade department, a new structuring of things. It could lead to further delay if key things don't happen before that election is
called. Also the issue that the post office is worth nothing in the eyes of the business department. It's been written down to zero. People are using cash less and less, and there are going to be questions going forward about what the post office is for and whether it should exist. And I would imagine that that report that Sir Wynne Williams eventually produces will feed into the decisions made by whichever party ends up being in power. Helen, before we go, I would invite you to tell the listeners to this podcast a little bit more about the Horizon Scandal Fund, how people can donate, what sort of work we are doing, and what we are looking for in terms of applicants, because we get money in, we give it out, but we're sort of trying to expand that, aren't we?
We created the Horizon Scandal Fund in 2021, hoping and still hoping it's going to be a very short-lived charity, because we're hoping that people won't need it. We're 18 months in and they still desperately need it. We are using, Nick is very kindly donating revenue from the book, and we're also getting donations from the public. The public have been absolutely fantastically generous. You can donate by going to horizonscandalfund.org, our website, and then you can just donate online. You can either donate just a one-off payment, or you can set up a monthly direct debit, which you can cancel at any time. We would be most grateful if anyone could donate. What we've done so far, we've donated money for hardship. We've prevented a couple of people from being evicted. Now, their evictions are still not guaranteed. They're still not guaranteed not to be evicted, but we've stalled the evictions. We've paid for people to have counselling, all sorts of things.
Short respite breaks is the thing that always gets me, because there isn't any compensation money available for giving people a holiday. But, people... We had one applicant who hadn't had a holiday in 19 years, and we were able just to pay for them to go away for a weekend with their children. And that sort of is when the scale of this scandal starts to hit you, mm-hmm. that people just haven't been able to have the space for any joy in their lives as a result of what happened to them.
And it's heartbreaking when you read the applications. It is absolutely heartbreaking, isn't it, Nick? It really is. And I know we've read all the heartbreaking stories. I mean, they're all in the book as well. But, you know, when you read some financially desperate people, and they're not doing this lightly. They don't want to be applying to a charity. They're very proud people. But when you you're facing losing your home, you think, well, OK, I'm going to have to do something. And they will apply to, you know, several people have applied to the charity, but not enough. So I would plead with anybody who needs some help and you haven't got your compensation, or even if you have and it's not enough, go to the charity, apply to the Horizon Scandal Fund. We'll see what we can do.
And we've made a point of making it a very, very simple process. All that triggers the process is an email, and the rest of it we can do either over the phone or just by knocking back and forth emails. There are no forms to fill in or anything like that.
So, yeah, I would urge people to apply, and I would urge people to donate if you possibly can. That would be brilliant. Thank you.
Thank you, Helen Lacey, trustee of the Horizon Scandal Fund and director of Bath Publishing. My thanks also to Robert Nicholson, award-winning producer of The Great Post Office Trial and senior editor at Whistledown Productions. I'm very grateful to you for giving up most of your bank holiday afternoon to come on and do this podcast. A lot of the things that we've discussed this afternoon. I will put in the what they call the show notes of the podcast, so there'll be links to the job advert that Professor Richard Moorhead has set up for a postdoc research person to look into the scandal. I'll put the Scandal Fund links up, and I'll put all the links to all the episodes of the Great Post Office Trial up as well. Thank you so much for coming on. Very, very grateful. Really appreciate your time.
Thank you, Nick.
Cheers, Nick. No, it was a pleasure.
Cheers. Bye.